Yes, Ms. Starr.
May it please the court, my name is Amelia Starr. I'm here from Davis, Polk, and Wardwell. I'm appearing on behalf of the appellants in this litigation, Zenica, Merck, and Abbott. This case is an appeal from the district court's denial of the appellant's motion for summary judgment and the district court's grant of the appellee's grant of a motion for summary judgment. If the court wishes, I can give you a brief factual background, or I can move straight to the argument.
Actually, this member of the court doesn't wish you to do either one of those things. I'd like you to discuss subject matter jurisdiction. I don't understand why the district court had any.
Well, this is was an action for declaratory judgment. The appellants are seeking a declaration as to the meaning of the contract.
I understand that, but the meaning, a settlement agreement is an agreement under state law. That's the holding of the Supreme Court in Kilconan, and therefore one would think the critical question is the existence of diversity jurisdiction, and parties on both sides are Delaware corporations, so there is no diversity jurisdiction. So I don't understand how the district court has subject matter jurisdiction.
The settlement agreement has specific provisions that state that when there is a dispute about its meaning, as varies between the parties.
It's not sufficient, Kilconan holds, for settlement agreements to so provide. A district court may be able to reserve jurisdiction if the judge does so expressly. Parties haven't pointed to any express reservation of jurisdiction clause in the district court's judgment. And moreover, at least one of the parties to this proceeding, REBCO, was not a party either to the settlement agreement or to the district court's reservation of jurisdiction. So that reservation can't be used for jurisdiction over REBCO, and of course REBCO is a non-diverse defendant. So I could imagine how an express reservation of jurisdiction could provide jurisdiction for a suit called Abbott against CVS. I can't see how REBCO can get into it under that theory. And under a straight diversity jurisdiction theory, this case can't exist. So that's why I'm puzzled about diversity jurisdiction. Is there some answer to this problem?
Well, the court did reserve jurisdiction to hear disputes about this, the meaning of this contract in the contract. And certainly when the court took this case, it took it on the understanding that it had reserved the rights and the obligation to construe what the contract
meant.
How
does that get REBCO into court?
Well, it certainly gets CVS Pharmacy in court, which is a party to the action.
Counsel, what you need is REBCO. CVS is not a party to the action that you are seeking to have enjoined. Only REBCO is a party to that action.
The
critical party in this case is REBCO, and REBCO cannot be here under a reservation of jurisdiction theory.
CVS, again, just to back up for a moment, CVS Pharmacy, the party to the action, acted as an agent of CVS Corporation, which is the corporate parent of both wholly owned subsidiaries, both CVS Pharmacy and CVS REBCO. Once we have CVS Pharmacy and CVS Corporation in the court, it is sufficient, even if we don't have CVS REBCO in the court, to interpret the contract and the obligations that those two entities have under the contract to obtain a release for my clients of the list of enumerated entities. Even if we were to say that CVS REBCO itself was not in this particular action, between those two parties, they have the authority in order to compel CVS REBCO to release its claims.
You want to turn to the merits?
You might consider the appropriateness of some supplemental filing. What you've said so far doesn't persuade me.
We would be more than happy to make a supplemental filing on the issues you raised, Your Honor.
Okay, so we'll ask both sides to do that.
And I think when you do this, you should address a question that the district court raised, been mentioned in the briefs here, and not addressed, which is why an anticipatory action is proper. For all I can see, this is a request for an advisory opinion on what would be an affirmative defense in REBCO's suit. Now, advisory opinions also don't strike me as something that's within the district court's jurisdiction. We've said in a series of cases that are not mentioned by the parties or by the district court, of which Pettibone Corp. against Easley back in 935 Fed Second is a very good example, that suits like this should not be entertained by district courts. That seems to me a second problem that's not discussed in either side's briefs here.
You'd have a monumental task of rebriefing the entire thing, I can see.
Well, we would be more than happy to submit supplemental briefs addressing all of the issues that you raise to assist the court in its analysis. To go back for a moment to the merits of the case, in our view, this is a contract case. The question is, what does Section 15 of the 1996 settlement agreement between Merck and Zeneca and the class plaintiffs, and Section 14 of the 1998 agreement that involves Abbott, mean? The appellants say that that agreement means exactly what it says, that the class plaintiffs and a list of entities that they are associated with the class plaintiffs provide releases to the settling defendants for all claims that they had, will have, ever had, whether asserted directly, representatively, derivatively, etc. And that's exactly what the appellants bargained for. They bargained for a very broad release. In return for their $725 million, they expected not to see the class members in litigation again or the members of the class's family. In other words, my client, Zeneca, and the other appellants didn't expect to see CVS Pharmacy or any of the CVS entities again in litigation, at least on this subject matter. The CVS parties, in their briefs, indeed concede that the release extends not only to the members of the class, but at least for certain purposes, to the enumerated entities who they concede are not class members. Specifically, they argue that the enumerated parties have released claims, but have released only the claims of the class members that could be asserted derivatively. This is a critical point. They've essentially have conceded and agreed with the appellants that the class members, in this case CVS Pharmacy, had the authority to release claims of non-class members, i.e. present, future, past affiliates. Once you get that far, you move to the logical conclusion of the appellant's argument, which is that CVS Pharmacy at least purported to release all of the claims, not only of itself, but of these entities that it purported to be authorized to release claims for, including
your
the affiliates.
Your point is somehow that the price of Revco, that CVS would have to pay more for Revco because Revco is losing its claim. Is that the idea?
Well, certainly CVS Pharmacy, CVS Corporation, and Revco, eventually now CVS Revco, knew about this release and knew about the logical effects of the release.
Your argument is, CVS, whether maybe if they had known the contract meant what you say it means, then of course Revco would cost more to CVS than it would to some other purchaser because it loses its claim if it's bought by CVS, right?
One assumes that while I was not a part of the negotiations, one assumes that the Revco shareholders negotiated sufficient compensation.
I'm saying if they knew what your interpretation was, then it means CVS had to pay more for Revco than another company would have had to pay.
That's correct.
Their acquisition extinguished an asset of Revco. Does that make any sense?
Well, see,
your interpretation of the contract, whatever basis it has in the language, seems to me complete toss-up one way or the other. I don't get the sense of it.
I see I'm actually
well, you can
have one minute
time.
Left, but let me
okay. Don't worry about you.
Let me answer your question. CVS Pharmacy and its parent CVS Corporation took on an obligation
in the settlement
agreement, and they were paid for that
obligation. That's begging the question. You think the language of the contract is clear. I don't. I think it's a toss-up. So it seems to me when you have a contract that's difficult to interpret, you like to see what kind of, purpose might such a contract have had. The contract interpreted the way you want to interpret it seems to me not to make any sense.
Well, from the standpoint of the appellants, it did make sense. They were getting a release from the CVS family.
No, that's begging the question. Why would such a broad release be the sort of thing for which people would negotiate? And your opponents give various hypotheticals. People have a few shares, you know, something of that sort. What is there some logic that underlies this kind of broad release?
Well,
something you're afraid of, something that, you know, the defendants are afraid of, and they.
Well, certainly, the defendant would, for example, not expect CVS Pharmacy or CVS Corporation to go out and buy the claims of opt-outs and then assert them against them. They expected to have peace with CVS Pharmacy. And the way the contract...
Why peace with CVS Pharmacy? What's that about? It's like the Middle East or something? There's a war between them and now... What's that about? Peace?
Well, these are companies that have ongoing commercial relationships, and it's in the appellant's best interest to be able to have good commercial relationships with CVS Pharmacy and its corporate parent.
Collusion or something, or what are these?
This is the relationship between a vendor and a customer. Good relationships between vendors and customers benefit both sides, and terminating this litigation was critical in order to restore that relationship.
We'll give you time to rebut, Ms. Starrs.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Shadowin?
Please, the Court. My name is Steve Shadowin on behalf of the appellees. Judge Easterbrook, we will be happy to file a supplemental brief. We did file a motion to dismiss on slightly different grounds. We cast it in terms of abstention, that unless and until these manufacturers had asserted the affirmative defense of release against Revco, then the proper place for this litigation, this issue to be raised within the prior pending litigation, and the district court denied that.
Where is that litigation now pending?
It's now pending in the Middle District of Pennsylvania. Judge Posner, pick up on your point on would it make any sense, does the manufacturer's interpretation make any sense? No, it doesn't. I think we've given in the brief many examples of the utter absurdity of their reading. Moreover, not only would this be a burden upon future commerce, think of the additional transaction costs of anybody who's contemplating entering into any kind of a relationship with anybody who may have given a release in the class case, to search out and determine whether or not that both parties were involved in that litigation and whether or not that class member may have given a release that had the surprising effect of releasing not only the class member's claim, but also the claim of some future person who has a future relationship with that entity. It simply makes no sense. Not only does it make no sense, it's arguably one of the primary reasons that the drafters of Rule 23 drafted that rule, and the reason why that rule was enacted. It used to be the case that common law rules of agency determined who was bound by class actions, then known as spurious class actions or in any kind of representative litigation. One of the principal virtues of Rule 23 is that it does away with the application of those common law rules and the indeterminacy and the wasted satellite litigation that results from it, as Judge Easterbrook wrote.
Does Rule 23 do away with any of that? And class actions usually, readily, and with injunctions as part of releases. And, of course, it's Rule 65D, not Rule 23, that determines who's bound by that terminating order. Do you think Rule 23 contradicts Rule 65D?
No, but I think that Rule 23 is the starting point. I believe that a principal purpose of Rule 23 is to determine at the outset of class litigation who is going to be bound by a judgment in the action and who is not. That's one of the express holdings of this court in Premier Electric.
That's what I don't understand. Who is bound by a judgment is usually determined by something else. If you look at the law of preclusion, for example, all persons, CVS is bound by this judgment, The law of preclusion is that all persons in privity, active concert, and so on with CVS will be bound. That's just an ordinary part of res judicata. Now, you seem to be saying that Rule 23 overrides the law of res judicata and limits the scope of the finding effect of the judgment to CVS and not CVS's privy.
I am definitely saying that.
That's inconceivable. Rule 23 doesn't have anything to do with the effect of privity on the law of preclusion.
With respect, Your Honor, Rule 23 expressly says that members of a damages class will be given an opportunity to opt out, and that those who do not opt out will be bound by the judgment, expressly in the language of the rule itself. The obvious corollary of that is that those who opt out will not be bound. And so whether or not it's cast in terms of Rule 23 overriding the otherwise applicable common law rules, at the very least, those common law rules must be read in conjunction with Rule 23.
I must say, that seems to me very strange. Let's suppose that CVS had acquired, instead of doing what it did, which is to acquire Revco as a subsidiary, that CVS had bought Revco's assets, right?
Right.
And just held the assets, including the chosen action, against Abbott.
Okay.
And now CVS asserts that claim in CVS's own name. Do you think there'd be any problem under this judgment?
I think that that claim would not be extinguished by the release in this case. Definitely. I think that...
It's awfully hard to tease that out of Rule 23. Maybe one could do it, as the district court did, by saying that somehow the opt-out clause in the judgment followed the assets rather than the corporate form. You, of course, have a much easier case. All you have to do is follow the corporate form.
That's right.
But saying that Rule 23 would, of its own force, require an opt-out to follow assets rather than corporate form... It seems to me, anyway, hard to tease out of the language of Rule 23.
Okay.
Anyway, what sense would it make?
It wouldn't make any sense, Your Honor. The manufacturers are reading of this as we've stated, and it's also, I believe, I know you stated that you think it's a toss-up, but I think when you carefully parse the...
Oh, that careful parsing, I'm going to say, that did absolutely nothing for me. Absolutely nothing.
All right, we won't carefully parse it then. But whether it's carefully parsed or looking at the broad picture of whether or not it makes sense, I think every...
You have to understand that you don't just parse things while watching the Weather Channel in the background.
I didn't understand how your Rule 23 argument made sense. I don't see what it is about a class action that would affect the fact that a judgment ordinarily binds a firm and the firm's successors and so on.
Well, it binds them to the extent that they are trying to assert the class member's claim. To the extent they have...
The assertion has anything to do with it. If a company can't, by selling its assets, enable its successor to bring a suit with it been a judgment. I mean, that'd be ridiculous.
Luckily, I suppose, in this situation, we don't have any of those things.
Sure.
We have separate corporate forms. We have a situation where the class member is simply a sister subsidiary,
well, the point
not
is
even
Revco
a parent.
Had, I take it your point is Revco had its own claim. It's not that CVS is trying to revive a claim by selling its assets or selling some piece of it to somebody else.
Exactly right. And, Your Honor, when it came time to divide up the spoils of that class settlement, none of the CVS entities submitted any claim on behalf of Revco. Revco maintained its own separate counsel, its own litigation strategy. Its interests at times were antagonistic to those of the class members. We were in motion practice against each other. So this is clearly a situation where these two corporate entities were going their own separate ways, and with respect to the Merck and Zeneca claims, the settlement was entered into three years before the corporate transaction on which they relied. So.
Go back for a second to your abstention argument that you made. There is something different here. We've said in a number of cases that when a judge is asked that when a question arises as to the meaning of a consent decree, for example, the judge who entered it is, it's a contract, but the judge who entered it is presumed to have, you know, some special insight into its interpretation. Similarly, if a judge approves a settlement agreement, the contract has been sort of negotiated in his presence, as it were, you know, in a loose sense. So he's the judge who, you know, is likely to have the best kind of interpretive competence. So doesn't it make more sense that Judge Koukouras should interpret this agreement than a judge in Pennsylvania?
It does, Your Honor, and we tried to get him to do that in the REVCO litigation. We brought a motion in the REVCO litigation.
In Pennsylvania?
No, when it was still before Judge Koukouras as part of the MDL, asking him to give a deadline to the manufacturers if they were going to assert the defensive release to do so. That this was after they filed their separate case. We went in the REVCO case, said the proper litigation in which to resolve this question is as an affirmative defense in the REVCO litigation. Please, if you're going to allow them to assert the affirmative defense of release at this late date, make them do it now before these cases are remanded so that you, Judge Koukouras, can decide this.
Before the transfer back to Pennsylvania.
That's correct, Your Honor. There's no suggestion that we were trying to run away from Judge Koukouras. On the contrary, everyone agreed he was the right judge to interpret it. And in fact, I think the cases on which Your Honor is to which Your Honor is referring, which you wrote, say that in fact this court itself gives some additional deference to the judge who entered the decree. And I would also, just in conclusion, I would say Judge Koukouras also looked beyond the specific term to the other terms of the agreement, to the surrounding circumstances, including to the fact that the class plaintiffs told him in their briefs in which they sought approval of these releases that they did not release the claims of any opt-out plaintiffs. He took all of that into account, all of which was undisputed. There were no disputed issues of material fact as to that. And he reached the obvious conclusion. This would be a complete and utter windfall to the defendants that has no rhyme or reason other than that it would extinguish a billion-dollar claim for no consideration.
Okay,
thank you, Your
Honor. And Ms. Starr, we'll give you another 2 minutes.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. Two brief points. First, Mr. Shadowin mentioned that the court below did look at various items of extrinsic evidence, including statements that were made during the settlement approval hearings. The contract is unambiguous. Both sides agree that it was unambiguous. Indeed, Judge Koukouras and the district court agrees that it's unambiguous. Evidence about what happened after the contract in terms of the settlement approval hearing or in terms of when this lawsuit was filed is irrelevant, at least for the purposes of construing the meaning of the contract. Second point that Mr. Shadowin spent some time discussing was the Rule 23 point. There is no reason that Rule 23 would bar the ability to, in a final judgment, which in this case we have, and that the settlement agreement was indeed included in the final judgment that was issued by Judge Koukouras, that judgment can still release the claims of opt-out. The question is, did the parties who released the claims, in this case CVS Pharmacy, have the authority to do so? And was that settlement approved and was it embodied in an order? And was the appropriate relationship of privity in existence? The mere fact that a party is an opt-out under Rule 23 does not mean that you cannot have a release of their claims. He also raised the question of why does this agreement make sense? Why would it make sense for it to be interpreted the way that the appellants advance? It makes sense because when defendants enter into settlements and provide consideration in return for releases, they do so because they expect that those releases, as drafted, are going to be enforced and that they're going to get the full benefit of the releases in the future.
But it's just fluky because if everybody understood your interpretation, REVCO still have its claim. It just wouldn't be sold to CVS. It'd be sold to someone else.
Well, REBCO
wouldn't gain any. You only gain something because you've sprung this interpretation on everybody. If it's known in advance, you know, then, as I say, CVS wouldn't be the purchaser.
Well, perhaps I see I'm done, but if you don't mind answering the question.
Yeah.
CVS REBCO may not have appreciated at the time that that this contract
was entered into. Right, that's the windfall aspect of it. Yeah, you pulled this rabbit out of your hat. They didn't anticipate it, and therefore REBCO got sold to the wrong person. But if everyone had anticipated your argument, you wouldn't benefit, because then if the claim was valuable, the company would have to be. I even wondered whether your interpretation was against public policy. You kind of put a restraint on alienation. REBCO becomes a kind of leper. It can't be acquired by some number of companies in this industry, because if it is, it loses its claim. Seems very odd.
Well, it doesn't mean that CVS can't be REBCO can't be acquired. Simply that it
can't be acquired by anybody who's a party to this settlement.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Arthur. Shadone.